Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com, or if you want to go straight to the good stuff, blog.speculist.com will get you right there. As with the website, the podcast is all about emerging technologies, emerging possibilities. It's all about looking forward to a future that we think we're all going to want to live to see. And with me, as always, is my co-host and co-blogger, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Excellent, man.
Good, good. Well, we're getting the new year off right here, bringing back one of our best guests from 2007. So if you want to go ahead and introduce our guest.
Absolutely. Well, we have with us tonight, Phil, Tobias Buckal, Tobias. He has been on our show a couple of times in the past, both on the occasions of the publications of books. He is a sci-fi author, and Tobias, we are very pleased to have you back, and even while you're in the middle of a book, so it's not even the occasion of a book. So
I'm happy to be here, actually, I just turned the third one in. I just turned in the copy edits to the publisher, so
twin
books.
Hey, we got an exclusive on that then, Phil. And what's the title of the third book?
The third book is called Sly Mongoose.
Okay, the first book, of course, was Crystal Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, I'm having a mental block. Tobias, what's the second book?
Second book is Ragamuffin.
Ragamuffin. And now we have Sly Mongoose. And, of course, the Ragamuffins and Sly Mongoose were, you know, groups of people that were introduced in the first book. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And you've taken those concepts and made new stories. Now, is the third book going to be like the second one, where you really don't have to read the previous books to understand and jump right in? Or?
Of course. I really value, as a reader, not having to, you know, read the previous books and jump right in. I kind of love writers who write series, not sequels. In other words, you know, it's just another adventure in this awesome universe.
All right.
I've got a great story about that, actually. For Christmas, my wife gave me the first two books in the Time Odyssey series by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter. Tobias, are you familiar with those books?
Yes.
Okay. So the third one has just come out, and so I was thinking, well, okay, they got three now. I really got to start reading these books. And she gave me the first two books, and so I started reading Sunstorm. And I'm about, 65 pages into it. It's a real page-turner. But all the while I'm thinking, man, this thing really throws you right into the middle of the action. I mean, I'm following it just fine. But, man, I set it down. I was eating lunch, and I looked, and it said, oh, book two of the series. I actually started with the wrong book. So those guys have done it pretty tight, too, because you actually could just pick it up and start reading.
Yeah.
Now I've gone back and started reading the correct one. Cause, you know,
even worse if you do like I did, because I can be a clueless wonder quite often. And read the entire second book, you know, including spoilers to the first book, and get to the end of it, and then pick up the first one and be like very confused.
That's right. Well, who's this person?
Disappointed.
So you took a kinder route for your readers and just said, okay, you can read any of these in any order and enjoy the whole world and the whole universe I've created.
Some reviewers have said that, you know, there's a lot more joy in reading the first one first and the second one second.
Well, because you will have that spoilers issue, I would think, if nothing else. I mean, you know,
if nothing else. But, you know, quite a few people picked up the second one and were intrigued enough to then move on to the first one. So, you know, I know that it definitely worked vice versa for a lot of people. And the third one, I would say, stands alone even more than the second one.
Well, can you give us any, a taste of what to look forward to for those who are familiar with the universe you've created?
Oh, sure. Sly Mongoose is a lot of fun. I was at speaking of upcoming scientific, you know, stuff, this is my most scientifically grounded novel yet. I happen to be attending a reading by Jeff Landis, and or a presentation by Jeff Landis, and he was talking about everything he knew about Mars, which he tends to do. He's sort of a Martian expert. He's a scientist at, of course, NASA. And in the course of events, he told me to stay for the next one about Venus. He thought I might find that fun, and I did. And he started talking about the fact that Venus sounds like a really inhospitable planet. It's got, you know, 800-degree surface heat, you know, which can melt just about anything we build. It's got 90 times Earth pressure or thereabouts, and it rains acid rain, sulfuric acid, which is really nasty.
So no, that's not. I don't want to put my summer home there.
No. You know, and of course you can't breathe the air because it's carbon dioxide. So all in all, it doesn't sound like a fun planet to chill on. But what Jeff said is that at 100,000 feet, it kind of everything's shaken up a bit, because at 100,000 feet, the pressure is the same as the Earth's, as far as the atmosphere goes, and the temperature is the same. And the only thing you have to worry about, since you're above the clouds, is not sulfuric acid, but just finding oxygen to breathe. And coincidentally, if you take air, which you need to breathe anyway, and put it in a big enough balloon or structure, it floats really well. It's a lifting gas, air on Venus, a very good lifting gas.
So a mixture, yeah, of, by air, you mean oxygen and nitrogen, I guess, right? So,
of course, yeah.
Okay.
Natural air that we need to breathe.
Our air, yeah, okay.
So basically, right, if you were to take, you know, a structure a mile wide and make a giant dome out of it, fill it with air that you need to breathe anyway, and put some people inside of it, it just floats at 100,000 feet. And it's one of the most hospitable places in the solar system outside of Earth at 100,000 feet in Venus's atmosphere.
That's amazing. I think we talked about this last time you were on the show, so you get the flying city,
in
Empire Strikes Back.
When he said
back,
that,
right?
I thought, wonderful, we've got Sky City, Cloud City. You know?
Right,
yeah.
It's Star Wars with a reason.
Star Wars with a reason.
Yeah. I love that.
And the great thing about being a science fiction writer is when you can take a trope and make it justifiable and rational and play with it. And I just couldn't turn it down. And so that's what Sly Mongoose is. For those who are interested, if you go on YouTube and you type in Sly Mongoose, I should have a book trailer up there already.
A book trailer?
Yeah. I put together
cool.
a little video presentation, kind of getting the core concepts across and showing the cover off.
Well,
what a great idea.
Well, you know, I can pull YouTube straight into our show notes, so I'm gonna find that trailer and put it in the show notes. That's great.
Okay.
Very cool. But we should point out that the book is not about Venus, right? It's about another. It's about
it's a
Venus
like
elsewhere.
The Venus-like city. I use Venus as the idea, you know, the concept, and it's actually another planet in my continuing string of planets that I've been exploring since Ragamuffin.
Right.
And you know, we meet some new characters who live in this world. You know, they have to be lowered down in what look like giant pressure suits to mine what they can from the boiling surface, and you know, we have airship chases, and you know, those sorts of things. It's a very rip-roaring, even more so than my other two novels.
Oh, sounds like a lot of fun. All right, well, we're looking forward to that. Actually, that kind of reminds me a little bit, since it was a science talk, you say, that kind of spurred you to have the idea to write this book.
Yeah.
But before the show, Stephen and I were talking for a few minutes, and we got on the subject of, you know, the kind of hard science fiction versus the softer, more fantasy type, and then there's, you know, there's other genres, the military type, and you know, science fiction mixed with fantasy. Where do you put yourself on, if you were going to plot all that out, where would you say you live in that spectrum?
I gleefully inhabit space opera, I hope.
Okay.
I hope that's how people would look at me, you know, which is somewhat hard, but SF, you know, we like SF and concepts and the science, but we tend to really, really love the big setting kick, the eyeball kick, the really vast structures and really over-the-top scenarios. So we don't let the science constrain us. We use it as a starting point for wild ideas.
You know, Phil and I have actually had conversations about this. We, in what we do, you know, Tobias, we gather science stories, we think about them, we wonder how all this fits together and try to imagine a future with all these different puzzle pieces, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we've come down to it, you know, we're not, and neither of us are scientists. I think that's fair to say, right, Phil?
That's very fair.
Okay.
I'm certainly not a scientist.
and so, you know, we don't know, our understanding of science is just based on what we read, and so we tend to, Phil has said it exactly this way, we tend to entertain the ideas that entertain us,
mm-hmm.
okay? And which is not good science, necessarily. But it's not, you know, We do try to be realistic about the scenarios that we come up in our mind. We were kind of thinking, now, how is that similar to what Tobias does? And is that kind of similar the way you go with it?
We're always mining science, for the inspiration.
Right.
And the harder the more science fiction-y the story is, the more you're looking to do that rigorous extrapolation.
Right.
And definitely, I see some commonality. Yes.
Yeah. You don't allow the science to constrain a good story. If you've
right.
got a good story there, you throw a little ESP in ESP into the story.
Or a little
ESP in, I suppose. You could put them in the future as well. But you know what I'm saying. You could throw a little soft elements into a story if it advanced the story, I suppose. But
yeah.
But you sort of see yourself on a little more on the hard end of sci-fi, though.
I would like to. I have no idea where history will judge me. But certainly, if you read Ragamuffin, my novel, I was very obsessed with sort of geolocative, layers of reality that could be laid down, like reality markup, I call it, that could be added to the environment that you're in. And I see a lot of that, that came about from my reading about stuff that people are trying to do with that today. So certainly, I try to cram as much of that in, but then, I'm not paid to be a full-time scientist, and so at some point, you do have to write the adventure.
That's right.
Well, I think one of the big similarities between what we do is that whether on the blog or any other futures, trying to put together a picture of what the world might be like, or a science fiction author trying to propose a potential future world, we both have this desire to create a compelling picture of what it's going to be like, right? That's definitely one thing that we have in common. The difference, I guess the big difference is the one you mentioned, Stephen. If the science gets in the way, we actually have to try to back off, although we look for ways around things ourselves sometimes when it's a really good idea. But
faster than light travel, I still want it. I don't care what the science says.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Things like that. But, I see you're exactly right. We try to, we try to get it right. I mean, although we're not scientists, we try to get it right. And I suppose especially when you're trying to write hard sci-fi, you're trying to get it right too, Tobias.
Yeah.
There's a lot of commonality there.
Well, and the other one that occurs to me is that for us anyway, because of kind of our specific orientation, we're always focusing, or not always, 80-20 probably, focusing on futures that we'd really like to see happen.
Right.
So we're always painting these pictures of, what a great world this would be, right? If this came into being, and how this change would work with this one, and you get this whole kind of scenario. Now, a science fiction writer doesn't necessarily work from that premise at all, right?
No. I mean, some of the classic science fiction is dystopian.
Right.
If this technology gets loose, here's what could really happen, and it's not going to be good.
But it's interesting from a story point of view.
Well, conflict drives story, so there's no
greater
conflict than, technology gone wrong.
Yeah. So,
I was thinking of one thing you said about getting it right, and I was thinking of, William Gibson, who influenced so much about the world we live in right now as far as the Internet and the cyberpunk revolution. And I was just reading an interview with him a long time ago where he's talking about the fact that he really didn't consult with computer engineers because all of them would have told him that there's no way there was the bandwidth in order to do the stuff he was imagining possible.
Yeah. He was imagining beyond what they thought was possible, and he turns out to be righter than they were, more right.
Yeah.
Partly
because people read that and were so compelled by it that they set about to figure out how can we make that happen.
Even though it's a dystopia.
Well, a lot of the technology's right, but the world isn't necessarily like what he describes. Although maybe more like
right.
it than we realize, I think maybe in some ways. But we're not as far in the future as they were in. Say Neuromancer.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call it dystopic. I mean, I felt when I first started reading his stuff that it was interesting because I think of it as blue-collar, real, street, gritty, in that he doesn't necessarily say that everywhere is like this. It's just that it was science fiction set down from the average guy's and lower-than-average guy's person point of view on the street in a large, gritty place. And so much science fiction seems to be previous to that. A lot of it was very much like, you know, teams of engineers inside of a NASA, you know, facility. And what he bought from it was this sort of real sort of very much a lower, you know, lower class looking out at the world type area, and it just felt so much more real. And it doesn't even, you know, I don't imagine that all the suburbs have been destroyed in a Gibson future. I think they kind of limp along, and they're out there, and they're people who live sort of middle class lives. I just think it's very focused on people who aren't.
Right. Yeah,
the,
I think
the burnouts. Yeah.
I think there's even a reference in Count Zero to that. Two of these characters who were involved in this, you know, were moving into cyberspace to carry out some kind of mission. You know, one remarks to the other, this is like your whole life, isn't it? You know, I mean, I've got a wife, I got a kid, you know. And it's
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, that all goes on, but William Gibson isn't interested in any of that, so we're not going to see anybody's, like, pleasant home life or anything like that, right?
Exactly.
We're going to see this kind of bleak world that they're living in that is of interest to him, and of course becomes very much of interest to us as we're reading the story.
Right.
But it does seem awfully bleak. I mean, it's not a very happy, cheerful future, that's for sure.
No. But it's kind of like, you know, Charles Bukowski's, you know, referencing the bar life that he lived and writing about. It doesn't necessarily mean that other people outside of that imagined life of his characters are not necessarily living normal lives.
Right. Right. Well, I was just watching. Let's take this up a notch and talk about something a little more highbrow, if we could, if you guys are ready
sure.
for that. Because I was over New Year's Eve was watching on American Movie Classics. They had the Planet of the Apes complete series. Okay, so this is this is the kind of stuff I'll allow myself to pig out on while I'm on vacation. So I sat down to watch those movies, thinking back. For one thing, guys my age, and I don't know, Stephen, you're a little younger, Tobias, I assume you're quite a bit younger, but for guys my age, there are two guys, okay? There are two absolute guys. One has got to be William Shatner, right? Captain Kirk, the guy, okay? and then the other one, a close second, has got to be Charlton Heston, right? Because you got Planet of the Apes, and you got Omega Man, right? You got Soylent Green. He was just like Mr., you know, out there in the, and also like Earthquake and stuff like that back at the time those movies were coming out. So I have these memories from my childhood and adolescence of watching these movies originally on TV. I never saw them in the cinema, but I have these memories of this just incredible, epic set of movies, you know, this mind-blowing science fiction set of movies. And I have to report that it disappointed just a little bit on
didn't hold up.
Didn't hold up very well. I got my wife to.
I'm shocked.
You know, I was selling her on it and selling her on it, and I had TiVo'd the whole thing, and I said, okay, well, we'll watch the first one, because as great as they are, the first one is absolutely the best one. Okay, let's watch.
I'll grant you that.
I can just imagine what she said to you after the film. Well, damn you, Phil!
Yeah, damn you all to hell! Getting right? The Statue of Liberty, and no, because she conked. I mean, she was asleep probably. I don't know, half an hour into it. Because the first thing I noticed about these movies is they're paced horribly. Maybe compared to the diet of cinema that we have these days, where it's just all continuous slam bam action. I don't know, but it just seemed like a lot of it's just like filler. You know, they have like two or three really interesting ideas that they want to get to, and they're going to take their time because they need to fill the 2 hours with stuff. So that was the one thing. So I lost her. She fell asleep. But I got to the end, and I was thinking, man, that's really just not very believable at all. You know, and what's sad about that is it starts out pretty convincing. I mean, it starts out the first few seconds are actually, it's a hard science fiction story.
Right.
You got Charlton Heston sitting in his spaceship, and he's talking about, well, we're a few months out, but we're traveling near light speed, and if the calculations are correct, like 600 years have passed on Earth.
Right.
Like, hey, an actual scientific principle in work. And then from then on, it's just all, you know, it goes it goes bad pretty fast. Then you get to the second one, because, of course, I pushed on, you know, should let her go to bed. I don't care. I'm watching. These are the best movies ever, you know, although I was starting to doubt after after the first one. The second one, of course, Heston couldn't be bothered. He had, a career to pursue. He was probably making an earthquake or something. So they bring in this James Franciscus, right, who, looked like him. And I don't know if we were supposed to forget that it wasn't Charlton Heston or if, you know, I don't know what the plan was there, but that movie, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, I think is the bleakest movie ever made. I'm gonna argue that that is one of the most horrible visions of the future you'll ever get. And I'm sorry, I'm talking about this.
Kind of worship that nuclear bomb.
Is that the one? Yeah, they worship the bomb.
Yeah,
you got the
yeah.
mutants living in the subway, worshiping the nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, Charlton Heston, who shows up for this cameo at the very beginning and the very end, and here's a big spoiler warning to anyone who's not seen Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I'm about to give away the ending of the movie, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know what? You've had 36 years to see this thing. and really don't. So Heston and Franciscus, they're trying to make sure they don't launch the bomb. The apes come in. The apes start shooting everybody up. Charlton Heston...
As apes are wont to do.
As gorillas. Hey, excuse me, as gorillas are wont to do, of course. Chimpanzees would wanted no part of that, which will lead us
There were different species involved in this one.
That's right. The orangutans they bossed everyone around. The chimps were the intellectuals and the orangutans were the gun-toting just vicious, brutal bad guys. So there he is, Heston, he's bleeding, and he turns to Dr. Zayas, the orangutan, head of the Ministry of Science, because they were bureaucrats, that's right. And this is all actually laid out a lot more clearly in the original novel by Pierre Boulle, which is fairly good. And I think the remake, which we'll get to in a moment, probably got closer to the feel of that original book maybe than they were able to pull up with the book. But anyway, I was about to give away the end of the movie, so... So here's Heston, he's bleeding. He begs Zayas for help. Zayas says, I'm not going to help a human. Humans suck. And so, So Charlton Heston, in an action that is totally ambiguous as far as I'm concerned, and you get to pick how the movie ends, okay, depending on your, level of cynicism. He either dies, and in just the throes of death, his hand accidentally hits the button, and launches the doomsday bomb and destroys the Earth, or he's so bitter that the orangutan won't help him that he deliberately hits the button and destroys the Earth. And in fact, I think that's worth pursuing. Guys, what do you think? Go. Don't go in theories.
I think the moral of this story, Phil, is that a lot of sci-fi has a shelf life, and Tobias is mindful of that, right? you try to write for the ages, don't you? As far as the ending that I saw when I first saw it, I thought it was accidental.
Okay, you thought it was accidental, Tobias? Thoughts?
You can never go home again.
That's true too.
Good point.
Yeah, the way those it's funny the way those fail to hold up, those memories you have of it, and then when you go back, for me it was like the A Team. Yeah. And those childhood shows.
The A-Team, there you go, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense now. I can't even remember what I thought. I just remember being sort of bewildered by the entire movie.
Yeah, it is. It's kind
of... what was that? Was my reaction.
Well, here's a thing that'll blow your mind, okay? I saw a little making of all the Planet of the Apes things that they also showed. And they were talking about stuff was cut out of Beneath the Planet of the Apes. One thing that was cut out, I don't think it would have added any clarity at all, but it was kind of interesting, was that there was a character in there who was a human and ape hybrid. That these mutants who lived under the city, they were trying all kinds of their own little genetic experiments, and they had created a mutant ape.
They're getting freaky down there in the subway caves.
Very freaky. Here's the kicker, though. This is the part that they throw off glibly, but it's the part that really got my attention when they said, but we had to cut that scene out. That was a little too objectionable, and we were afraid the movie would lose its G rating.
Wow. It's okay to destroy the earth, but getting freaky with chimpanzees, that's crossing the line. Wow.
I can't believe that a movie that ends with, you know, a nuclear holocaust was a G-rated movie. That just absolutely astounds me.
Ooh-wee.
Anyway, I won't. I did then watch Escape, which is quite a bit better, and didn't bother with the others. All that's to say that there was a dystopian view of the future where they didn't let the science get in the way whatsoever. Or logic, or, you know, good storytelling, good acting, good special effects, any of that.
Well,
maybe
it sort of reminds me of I Am Legend. I just saw that, Phil, and the science is all out there and everything, but it manages to be a good story, so I enjoyed it.
Tobias, have you seen I Am Legend?
Yes, I did.
We keep getting to this movie on this show, and I still haven't seen it, but what your thoughts on that?
I thought it was pretty good. You know, many people have pointed out the problems with it, particularly with sort of the ending, some of the, you know, whether or not it held true to the, you know, to the book, or whether it was just a remake of Omega Man and so forth and so on. I was just particularly taken by the rather tense filmmaking in terms of the shadows when he enters the buildings and encounters the creatures, and how well that was done. It's been a long time since I was on the edge of my seat with a particularly well-done set of scenes like that.
And you really believe that Will Smith, for example, when his alarm goes off, that it's time to close up for the night. I mean, the dread that's written on his face. I mean, that and you know, and his interaction with the dog and all the, you know, all of that. It's just so believable and good that you can take the problems of a movie like that and set them aside and just enjoy it for what it is. And
Well,
I guess you do that with a lot of sci-fi, really. I mean, you know, particularly if you happen to know the science and you know that, well, this is just not possible, you just set it aside and enjoy the movie and the book or whatever.
The one small tweak in that, it bugged me in that it did humanize the I forget what they're called now, Darkseekers. In the original book, I mean, gosh, I hope people are literate enough that if I talk about the ending, I'm not going to get shot here. Stop me now.
Well, you can stop listening to the MP3 if you're,
Fast forward.
That's it.
And you know, in the book, the idea is that, you know, he's the last man on Earth, not that he's going to save mankind, but that he's sort of a curiosity that the Dark Seekers are remembering him, you know, and what he does.
Yeah.
The questionable morals of what he did, because they have become the new humanity and he's the old humanity and he's dying out, but he clings to trying to save humanity and convert them back and does some questionable things. And it's interesting in the movie that you get a hint of that, you know, when they try and capture him, because he's captured one of them. They you know, are trying to get out into the sunlight to get at him to stop him from doing the things he's doing. And so I just thought it was very curious that the movie had hints of that book in it still, but then didn't go down that path.
They didn't go down that path at all. He was apparently
watching the movie. I'm wondering what are these dark seekers do seem to have souls and think, and you know what I mean? They seem to be thinking creatures, not mindless animals. And so it's interesting that the movie then chose to take the path it did, because I started to, as a science fiction, you know, watcher, begin to question, you know, what does that mean? You know, what's the context of what he's doing now mean in light of the fact that they may be a new species of their own?
Interesting. So it raises some fairly fairly serious issues in a way.
On purpose, I don't think.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah, the original book did, for sure.
The original book did, for sure, and I think that they tried to follow the Omega Man, but a little bit of the book kind of stuck with them, and they didn't really flesh it out.
Yeah, I really don't remember there being any serious issues raised in Omega Man, but it's been a few years.
Right.
In fact, when I heard that this movie was coming out, that it was a remake of Omega Man, my thinking at the time was, well, Will Smith is no Charlton Heston. This is never going to happen. Now I'm thinking Charlton Heston's no Charlton Heston either. So
your memories have been tainted by
give him a shot. Yeah, you know.
Sunlight has been shown in on that. I thought it was an interesting movie, and it was an interesting path. But yeah, he was a legend in the original book. He was a legend to the the Dark Seekers, I guess, and
yeah.
And in this movie version, that's not that he's still the title character. He's still Legend,
right?
But it's no longer Legend to them. So anyway, it was some interesting changes they made there.
Well, the other change that they made was surprising to me, and I get, you know, they're making it for an American audience, so be it. But after being a movie that's very rational and based in rational questions, you know, we've created a virus, we're trying to survive from the mutations of it, you know, we're trying to build a cure. The person who knows, you know, the woman shows up and she's like, you know, God told me that there's a safety place. And he's like, I've never heard of a safety place. And she says, oh, it'll be there. You know, all of a sudden it's this, you know, there are all these religious implications and faith and whatnot. And it came out of nowhere. And I was kind of like, what's going on here towards the end?
Yeah. It was almost an idea from The Stand being thrown in.
Exactly.
You know, God speaks louder because there's fewer people, that kind of thing, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
It was thrown in, I mean, almost exactly the same way. And it was, and like you say, it was out of the blue because they had not set that up at all.
It works in The Stand for me. You know, I'm not particularly religious, but I like The Stand, actually, even though it is highly, because it's a thread that works all throughout The Stand, you know.
Right, yeah, he sets it up from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But
in this context, it came out of the blue, much like the sort of crucifixion sequence of Spider-Man in that second book where he's strapped to the front of that subway car.
I never saw that in terms of a crucifixion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know, he's spread
and
out.
And then when
he's taken off the front, yeah, he has a rip in his side, and they kind of carry him on their shoulders and lay him down, and he's got his feet crossed. And
I saw it immediately. Yeah, that was there.
Right over my head.
Wow. Well, you were just enjoying a Spider-Man movie, Phil. You didn't know you had. Didn't know you had to carry your Bible in there.
Back to the Omega Man, actually. Let me bring this full circle. Okay,
here we go.
I can help us out here. This will all have meaning and come around here because my critique of the Spider-Man one is I didn't feel the crucifixion sequence works because the crucifixion means you give up your life or something of incredible value to save the people.
I disagree, Tobias, but we'll get to that in a second. Go ahead and make your point.
You know, something has to be given up that's major. And so when Spider-Man is crucified, it seems cheap to me because it really doesn't cost him all that much to save those people on the subway car. And in Omega Man, the crucifixion sequence at the end of it is one I cite as a perfect example of using it in a movie to really bring home some impact. Because at the very end of the Omega Man, Charlton Heston is lying in that fountain bleeding out, and he's in a perfect crucifixion pose because he's just handed over the last vial of blood that will save all of humanity.
Right.
Okay.
And that really is a good use of a crucifixion scene, where I felt the Spider-Man one was a cheap sort of way to manipulate certain people.
Well, the reason I disagree, Tobias, is because Peter Parker, by then he had his mask off, right?
Right.
He had made the decision that he was either going to save those people or die trying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think it worked. Why it worked for me. I found that a very touching scene.
But
in a comic argument. Book movie of all things.
But
yeah,
maybe not as
argument for it.
Maybe not as straightforward an application of the motif, right, as what you're getting in.
Absolutely. I can see there's quite a bit of difference there between that and the Omega Man use of it. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Well, now, that,
you brought it full circle, and that was pretty impressive.
You brought it around, man. You brought it back to Omega Man. Now we should really move away, but I can't help it. I've got a couple more things I got to say about this because you want to mess this whole thing up. How about that crucifixion in which one of the Matrix movies was it?
Oh.
How valid of a crucifixion scene was that? You know, was that on that scale? If say Omega Man is a pretty good one and Peter Parker is an okay one, you know, where's that one fit? I felt like so much of that movie, it was just kind of there to.
I think they were just trying to hit some buttons.
Yeah,
I don't think that they're actually
and/or annoy the audience.
Let's see if we can. Let's see if we can, make the fundamentalists cringe a little bit. I don't know that they were actually moving the story along with that.
I think they were getting pretty desperate at that point for trying to get the movies, get those sequels to do something.
Yeah, I think so too. I really think they painted themselves into a corner by making sequels to The Matrix. It might have been
The Matrix. The Matrix was a wonderful movie that stood alone, and to me, the sequels, you just put them on a shelf. Animatrix, the animated thing, was actually there were sequences in that that were far better than the two live action sequels.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I thought it was much better.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, you know, about those sequels was that they gave credence to the one woman who was suing the Wachowski brothers for stealing her idea. And, you know, the first time I heard that, you know, that always happens whenever there's a successful movie. They actually have a budget reserve for that. When they make a movie, it's part of their expected fees, you know, just to have to fight a legal battle or pay someone who claims that that's their idea. And, you know, so when I heard that there was a woman, you know, suing the Wachowski brothers, I thought, okay, yeah, whatever, that always happens. And then when the second one came out, I thought, she might have a point, because there's such a difference between the two movies. It's like night and day. You just sort of like had that little thought in the back of your head, like maybe they did rip off a script and then not know what to do next.
Yeah, they should have asked her to write the sequel, and everybody would have been fine. She would have gotten the big money that she deserved, and we would have gotten better movies, maybe. I don't know. I hate to dog them too bad, because the first movie was so good.
The first movie was still worth having to put up with it.
Yeah, because you can sit through those other two, and then you go, okay, well, that's whatever. But
yeah,
they come on TV, and you don't watch them. And
we'll wait for the reboot.
Life goes on. Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. Now, we did have one final comment about I Am Legend here, that one of our guests in the chat room wrote, I found it amusing that the bad guys had pants on.
That's really good.
It's 3 years later in these wild creatures.
3 years, they've been walking around feral, and they still got their pants on. That's, you know.
Yeah, and even the
really good Levi's.
Even the female that they that he captured, she was wearing a top, you know. apparently, they're all shirtless except for the women.
There you go. It's the Incredible Hulk effect, you know.
All the clothes will be ripped.
Rip off all your clothes except for those you have to have on in order to pass Comic Code Authority, right?
That's right.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you can kill billions of people in a movie, but you can't dare show one naked.
There you go. Well, once again, we got to keep that G rating for the Holocaust, so as many kids can see it as possible.
You got to keep the G rating for the Holocaust. Oh man.
Oh, it's sad state of affairs. Okay, have one more movie thought before we move on to other things, because I know, Stephen, you've got other things you want to talk about tonight, and we've kind of gotten off this huge tangent, but it's so much fun. You guys looking forward to seeing Cloverfield?
You know, I would say I'm looking forward to it, but I don't know what I'm looking forward to, so I'm not sure if I should be looking forward to it.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's like their marketing of this is just to put a big question mark in your mind, so maybe you have
really,
to go to the
movie. But it could be the next, you know, it could be the science fiction version of Snakes on a Plane, for all I know.
Right.
Yeah, we really don't know, do we?
No.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think? What are your thoughts as to what it could be, Phil? That there
better be a big monster. Or I'm going to be really disappointed.
Well, it's got to be a huge monster. It'd be like chucking that Statue of Liberty's hat around. I mean, that's the only thing we really know from the trailer.
Right. You know, when I was watching that trailer, I was thinking, you know, this is what that Godzilla remake should have been. You know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, because this is scary. I mean, The trailer they first started showing, I don't know, was it earlier last fall, was it in the summer? But you just saw this trailer, you know, these people at a party, and then all of a sudden there's explosions going on outside, and all of a sudden the Statue of Liberty's head appears in the street, and people are screaming, and it's chaos. And that was the whole trailer,
yeah.
Right? It didn't say Cloverfield coming soon or anything, you know? It just gave a date that the movie was going to be released. So it's very clever marketing, if nothing else.
Very clever.
But I've read one set of speculations that the monster will never be shown.
Oh, wow.
I'm starting to think, well, you know, that might be one way you could pull that movie off, actually, at this point. Cause,
Because,
I mean, what's it going to look like that's going to measure up to just the sort of dread that they've created with that trailer? I really don't know what it could be. I mean, if it was Godzilla, it would be funny, right? I'd get a kick out of that, but it would not be, you wouldn't take it seriously anymore, right? You would think.
Right.
Oh, they pulled a good one over on us that time.
they'd have to throw in Godzuki just to make it interesting.
Right.
Anyway, yeah.
I admit, I'm quite intrigued.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here. That's one I'm very much looking forward to, and I have a feeling I'm going to be terribly disappointed, but
you're hoping you're not.
Well, J.J. Abrams, the guy, when he delivers incredibly. So we'll see what he comes up with.
Give the man a chance.
He's got the Star Trek franchise in his hands now, so we've got to believe he can do good stuff, right?
I got a lot of people that I've read recently that a lot of people are a little concerned about the direction he's going with that, with the Star Trek franchise. Obviously, for those who don't know, it's set when Kirk, for the most part, it's set when Kirk and others are still in the Academy together, Starfleet Academy, and they have a whole segment around the Kobayashi Maru. And there's a rumor that, it turns into this big scandal that he cheated on with the Kobayashi Maru. And, there's protests on graduation day. There's protesters all around. Kirk cheated, with signs and everything. I'd be very interested to see where in the world they go with that and how that plays into the entire movie.
That's kind of interesting because it's like, who cares, right?
Yeah.
We all know he went on to become a captain in Starfleet. Yeah. So.
And saved the Earth many times, so give the man a break.
My one big fear about that is that you take it back to Starfleet Academy. Okay, there's two things that I fear. One is that they're just going to rip out all the continuity that we currently know, which they've always felt free to do anyway. But but having Kirk and Spock meet at Starfleet Academy is just not the timeline, the sequence of events that we know at all. So I'm concerned about that. And maybe they've got some way of pulling it off. I don't know. But
they'll just ask us to forget it. It's sort of, forget what we know. It's sort of like with young Sherlock Holmes. It worked.
Well, yeah, they opened up at the beginning and said, "Yeah, we know." In the books, it says they met later, but in this story, we're going to say they met younger. I don't know.
Come along for the ride, and you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, if they do that, I guess I'd be okay with it. Sure.
Yeah.
But the greater fear, and this one I will not forgive, giving my Don Corleone threat here, okay? This I will not forgive, is if they turn it into, like, if they make Starfleet Academy like Hogwarts, okay?
Oh, yeah.
If it's like, Jimmy Kirk's wacky adventures in his school days, I don't know.
Well, the other rumor is that he's able to cheat on the test because he seduces the program writer, who's a hot babe, obviously.
Okay, well, now that's my James Kirk right there.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I want to hear. Okay.
Yeah. Let's hope she's an Orion slave girl type.
Yeah, if she's blue, then the movie's getting all kinds of cred with me. But we'll see.
Anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to that one as well. But, yeah, Cloverfield comes first. I guess we get Star Trek in the fall? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure when it's coming out. All I know is we bring a writer onto the show, and then we just slum talking to Star Trek and Planet of the Apes.
We're so sorry, Tobias. We drug you through. You're the one that started it when you said you were going to raise this to another level.
I was kidding. It was a joke. So anyway, let's talk about more. Let's. Serious. I know you've got a lot of serious stuff you want to talk about, Stephen. So I'm going to turn the show over to you, and hopefully we can
salvage this somehow.
Yeah.
Well, Tobias, I hate to shift gears on you too bad, but I guess I kind of need to. Did you get to watch any of the presidential debate yesterday?
I unfortunately was in transit to Pittsburgh, so
okay.
I did not have a chance to see any of the debates. Now, sorry.
Well, we on the show.
Wait, let me just one thing. Since you went ahead and apologized for it, let me just say I had every opportunity and could not be bothered to turn it on. Okay. So.
Well, it was 4 freaking hours.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to watch that? I watched some of it. And
yeah, but the Daily Show is not on. It's really hard to catch all the important highlights.
Exactly. Well, fortunately, my wife was talking to her mom in Malaysia who was watching it, so I got a few highlights that way. And
yeah.
I felt like that was all I really needed. But Stephen, you soldiered on. You watched all 4 hours, or
no way, no way. Okay. I watched the last half of the Republican part of it, and then moved on to a movie or something. when they started the Democratic half. I unfortunately didn't stick around for the second half. But anyway, it was what I thought was interesting, though, Tobias, was that several weeks ago we had a great guest on by the name of Robert Zubrin, and he had written a book called Energy Victory. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, he's the Case for Mars guy, right?
Exactly. That's the guy. And we wanted to talk with him about the Case for Mars, and we got him on the show. And actually, I wasn't present that night, but Phil got him on the show, and he was so brilliant in speaking about his latest book, Energy Victory, that's all y'all talked about.
He really got our attention with it. I mean, he had sent me a copy of the book, and I thought, well, okay, great, we'll have him on, we'll do 15 minutes of this thing, and then we'll talk about Mars. But there was no opportunity to talk about Mars because it was just very compelling what he had to say. It was a very interesting scenario that he was outlining for how we might deal with getting ourselves off foreign oil, talking about implementing flex fuel as standard for all U.S. cars, and talking about why that was important economically for us, also politically, and on a kind of a geopolitical level, why it's important for us to stop buying foreign oil, because so much of that money goes to the funding of
non-democratic activities.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, that's
he was a little bit more straightforward. He said we're funding the war against us, is what he said.
Yes.
Yeah, we're funding both sides of the war, you know.
Yes.
And which
to protect the oil and yeah, exactly. And by buying the oil, we fund both sides. And
my,
also,
my only objection to the flex fuel or biofuels is that we're already seeing the impact of increased usage of them, which is that food prices have moved up about I think it's as much as 14%. So the problem is when we turn to using the food to fuel our cars in the form of biofuel, is that we're starting to struggle now with we're starting to reduce, you know, free food sent abroad, and in terms of food that we buy here, since those prices for those core things that go into a lot of our food is now being switched over to being made for fuel, or we're starting to pay higher prices on bread and everything else.
Yeah, well, that is a major concern. One of the possible solutions to that is you make ethanol just out of the waste products rather than out of food products,
right.
And you're well ahead of the game. You can make it out of cellulose, and then you don't have that problem.
Did you talk about the air car?
No,
the air pressure car where you like.
Yes.
Well, actually, no. He
tell
didn't.
Us more.
Since we're on a science and cool concept.
Yeah, please.
You had us at air car, man. You couldn't go.
The air car is this car that's made in France, and it's an absolutely fantastically intriguing idea where they take pressurized air. They take like a giant scuba tank basically and hook that up to a piston. So the engine is of a familiar design. It uses pistons, you know, driven by air pressure. And so the fuel container is actually a giant scuba tank, basically. It's pressurized to two or three times higher than a scuba tank, but it's all technologies that we have that are fairly simple and very mechanically oriented today. And what you do is you basically fill up your air tanks in a car with pressurized air, and you use that to drive around. And it sounds like a car. It uses a lot of the same, you know, moving parts of the car, and it's very easy to sort of adapt existing cars to using air, with the exception of the fact that our cars are really heavy now. The air car is typically looks more European. It's very light construction. But the efficiencies they're getting out of this thing look extremely promising, and what you do then is you are able to switch over to the transition to using air cars would be more intriguing than the ones I'm currently seeing now.
Well, what's interesting about that is, and now that you mention it, I think not only have I read something about this, I think we blogged about this maybe about a year and a half ago. I think there's a company in India that's looking to distribute these there. The notion has really caught on in India for some of these reasons. I mean, it's a much lighter vehicle, and you can run it for really cheap. And I guess if the only power source is the air tank, if you're just pumping air into the air tank, then essentially you're running it's like an electric car. It's like a battery. You're running the car off the grid at that point. Right?
Well, what's even better about this car is that, A, you don't have to choose what your charging power source is. If you want to build a generator that runs off of fuel that pressurizes it, you can stick with fuel for right now. But if you wanted to run a nuclear power plant that had electricity that runs an air compressor in your house, you know what I mean, you can then choose that method. Or you could, you know, run it off of renewable resources. So the car becomes independent of whatever primary fuel source your neighborhood, your country decides to standardize on. And I think that's important because, you know, fuel cell cars or, you know, flex fuel cars or whatever like that, I think could, you know, trying to make a decision on one of those could be problematic. But the air car kind of removes itself from the problem of deciding what do we use for our primary power source.
You know, one important thing that I know that they have thought about is how you make sure that in times of failure, you know, in an accident or something, that
right.
it doesn't turn into shrapnel, you know.
Exactly.
And they say that they've built it to where, it, you know, if it fails along a seam mm-hmm. so that it just basically it peels open rather than exploding.
Explodes. Yeah. I mean, and that's similar to scuba tanks today.
Yeah. And they make scuba tanks that way where they fail gracefully rather than exploding like a bomb.
I may be mistaken on that, but I think that they're made to fail gracefully now.
Okay.
Or
well, that makes sense.
Coming up.
Well, and plus, I mean, maybe I don't follow this as closely as I should, but when was the last time you heard of a scuba tank exploding?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not
frequent. And the other thing is, of course, you know, we already use a high failure automobile.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we got gasoline too, crying out loud. Yeah.
Yeah, when was the last time you saw a car in flames?
Combustible fuels in the back of our car.
Yeah, you've seen that one. I mean, right? It's true.
As long as you put your tank in the center of your car, you've got a pretty good bet that it's not going to explode upon impact.
Yeah, you got a good chance it won't happen at all. And then if it's engineered to, you know, to fail gracefully, then maybe nobody get hurt, even if it does explode. Yeah.
I think
your ears will be ringing, I bet.
I like any idea that that opens up choices. And one of the reasons I like Zubrin's book so much is that the flex fuel vehicle really gives you a lot more options than we currently have. Yeah, it sounds like air car. That really opens it up because suddenly you can run the whole thing off the grid. One thing I did want to come back to was that the notion that that biofuels cause a food shortage. I would recommend that you read the book because Zubrin spends quite a bit of time on that, and in fact argues that we have the agricultural resource, the agricultural capacity on this planet to feed ourselves and to produce an enormous amount of liquid fuel. It partly has to do with the politics of we don't support developing countries' agricultural economies. In fact, we try to hold those down because we want to support
food, which kind of causes the opposite problem.
Yeah, so they're discouraged from growing food. And then the other thing is when we try to implement something like ethanol in this country, it becomes a big political boondoggle, and we're making it out of corn, which is probably not the best thing to be making it out of anyway. If we're going to grow corn,
switchblade grass is the preferred option.
Well, that's one excellent option.
You know, my family is actually looking at doing that. We just need to have the infrastructure in place locally, and that's being brought in.
Oh, wow.
We have a couple hundred acres just north of us, just north of Shreveport here, and we're gonna be planting it just as soon as the infrastructure is brought in.
And that's going to be used for making ethanol?
That's exactly what it's going to be used for. There's no other use for it, really.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So there's no possibility of competing. Yeah, some of these other crops he talks about would be much closer to the success that Brazil is having with sugarcane, if we were to use mm-hmm. sugar beets or fodder beets or sorghum or some right. of those things, or to import them from other countries where they need to be building up their agricultural infrastructure. Anyway, but the idea of just using something like that people weren't going to eat anyhow, you know, I mean, that seems like a pretty straightforward way to go about doing it. So when are you guys going to be in this business?
Well, it looks like that the infrastructure, in other words, the local guys that will gather up from the farmers, you know, the switchgrass, that's scheduled to be brought in the next couple of years. And so as soon as they open up, we're going to plant. And so,
all right.
And
last week it's your brother and his solar power. Now
yeah.
this week somebody else in your family. This show is really
it's
just
my dad this
time.
It's becoming the Gordon family.
It's not something you blog about. It's a passion.
Yeah, that's right. We live it.
We're all going to be working for Stephen one day.
Oh, man.
It's a strange feeling.
Well, get used to it, Phil.
Yeah, well, no, I look forward
to it. Well, you're
fired. I absolutely look forward to it. I for one, welcome our Gordon
overlords or whatever.
Yeah, our new Gordon overlords, for sure.
Oh, man. Anyway, the ideas from Zubrin, of course, Glenn Reynolds had been interested in it before we did our show. I don't think it'd be fair to say that we turned Glenn on to Zubrin, but anyway, those ideas.
Well, what would be fair to say was he linked us, right? He linked the fact that we had interviewed Zubrin, and then a couple weeks later he interviewed Zubrin. Okay.
Right.
To be fair, I learned about the air car from Glenn.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
And I think we did too. Yeah. So we feed off of Glenn, and he feeds off of us every now and then. So
well, yeah.
So
that'd be about it. Let's not even talk ratio. Go ahead.
Yeah, we don't want to go there. But
yeah.
Glenn interviews him for his show. Then the McCain campaign contacts Glenn right after that show, same day. And says, great show. Of course, Senator McCain is all about these sort of ideas. And then last night's debate, I heard Zubrin's words repeated back almost verbatim from Senator
McCain.
Really? Yes.
That's intriguing.
And then, of course, every one of the Republican nominees jumped on those ideas and said, yeah, we're all about that too. And so it's fascinating that, energy, those ideas from the from that book are being
watching,
heard loud and clear on the national stage.
Live mimetic transmission. You saw it here first.
That's right. We're on the cutting edge.
Draw the line, okay, for everyone listening, okay? Zubrin was on our show. Then Glenn interviewed him. Okay, then the McCain campaign picks it up. Now all the candidates are talking about this stuff. Okay, so
anyway, I've got an audio excerpt.
We have changed history, I guess, is what.
I've got an audio excerpt of the of Senator McCain's response last night. It fascinated me so much. I said, "Well, I got to get this for the show." And
okay.
So I hope you guys.
Let's have a listen.
All right.
Let me move on. People in this state and everywhere are worried about gas prices. When 2007 began, oil was $61 a barrel. It was $100 last week. We haven't even begun to see the demand that India and China is going to put on the world's oil markets. Don't you have to, in the end, level with people that gas prices are at this level to stay, and if anything, they're going to go higher? And isn't not to do so intellectual dishonesty?
At that price of oil, we're going to send $400 billion a year overseas to oil-producing countries. Some of that money will end up in the hands of terrorist organizations. It will certainly end up in the hands of dictators who do not have our interests or our values and sometimes want to harm America. We have to reduce the dependence on foreign oil, and we have to address the issue of greenhouse gas emissions. I think it's a nexus of two critical issues facing this country: alternate energy, nuclear power, wind, solar, tide, hybrids. We have to unleash the technology of America, and we must reduce and eventually eliminate this dependency on foreign oil, because it has become a national security issue, and we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, because I believe there's enough evidence that we are going to damage this planet beyond repair unless we begin to address that issue.
All right.
Okay. John McCain. Wow.
Yeah, well, so it was basically, Zubrin's ideas, plus throw a little concern for the, greenhouse gas emissions and all that, throw that in too. But
if you read the book, though, Zubrin is concerned about that as well.
I haven't gotten to that chapter yet.
Yeah.
I have started the book.
Well, what's interesting to me about that is it seems that he picks up on the whole, we don't want to fund the other side of the war on terror anymore, but he's not terribly specific about what we're going to do.
Right.
You
never want, if you're a politician, you don't want to nail yourself down to specifically
actually saying anything.
Yeah. I don't think that's necessarily shifty as much as it is just probably wise, but I mean, because you don't know where where it's going to be exactly. But he mentioned nuclear in there, and
that's true.
and all the and it seemed like every person on the stage then started talking about, you know, we haven't had a nuclear power plant in this country in 30 years, licensed a new nuclear power plant, and that we got to change that. And that's I think that that's I see that as a way that we're going to be going. Tobias, I mean, do you have any thoughts on that as far as how we're going to power the future?
You know, I really was intrigued. I'm sort of jokingly referred to myself as a sort of environmentalist-loving nuclear person. You know,
me too.
I really think that it's intriguing. Unfortunately, Carl Schrader once dropped a line on me that pointed out the problems with getting enough nuclear fuel to sort of ramp everyone up onto it. There is sort of a finite amount of material that can be dug out that's nuclear, and seemed to indicate to me that you know, we need to worry about fusion, or I think that it's fusion that hasn't been, you know, quite gotten yet.
Yeah.
Still seems to be a much better option, but I still seem to think that
fission may get us to fusion, like so many other technologies have,
right,
have bridged the gap to the newer and better thing. Yeah,
I think it's a better investment. I mean, right now coal is putting, you know, people are worried about radioactivity, but we're getting, you know, more radioactivity pumped into our atmosphere thanks to coal, because it also has radioactive properties when it's processed. You know. So, I'd rather safe nuclear power, you know, done than dumping what we're dumping into our atmosphere right now. And other than that, I'm very intrigued with the fact that I think it's the U.S. Navy? Army. The U.S. Army recently just did a big study about solar mirrors, and they're investing an enormous amount of money to get some solar, like, you know, you take a solar mirror and you focus it towards a certain spot on the ground, and you sort of gather all the sun's rays and send like a super, you know, beam of light down to a collecting station to run it. And I've talked to a small island out in the Pacific, I forget which one it is, about running, you know, running a whole island using a mirror in space just as a test bit, because the Army would like mobile power more than anything, and they think the idea of having mirrors in space that they could redirect and point to a new Navy or Army base somewhere that's just moved there would be terrifically useful.
Sounds like a good weapon too.
There you go.
Don't look up.
Yeah.
You know, why would the Navy have been interested in the first place?
Yeah, sounds a little like what I used to do with ants with my magnifying glass.
It does. It really is pretty much the same principle, but it's interesting that, you know, it's always the counterintuitive organizations that suddenly might give us a big, huge bump in this, you know, alternative technology, you know. But, you know, for some reason it amuses me that the Army is one of the largest spenders in green technology research, you know, because they're quite aware of the fact that oil is becoming harder and harder to obtain, and that affects the Army.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they want to figure out ways to become less dependent on it so that if, you know, stuff really does hit the fan, they're still effective.
In fact, I just saw a story last week about the Air Force running its first jet ever that runs off coal. I mean, it's not coal directly, but they've taken
right.
coal and they've refined it into a fuel that'll power that. And a couple weeks ago, we were had a thread going about a sane energy policy, and somebody had written in about really interesting Department of Defense stuff that's going on with hydrogen fuel cells. We had kind of blown off hydrogen as a possibility because of some of the basic mathematics involved, but apparently the Department of Defense has not written that off, and they've got some interesting stuff going on there. Yeah,
they really do some blue sky stuff, you know, that when everyone else is thinking, you know, that it'll be 100 years before that's of any use to us, they're the guys that are going, well, we better get to work on it then.
You know,
yeah, that's
exactly.
Just right around the corner. Yeah, so it is fascinating. It's those guys. We got a commenter that said that the space mirror sounds like Real Genius. If y'all remember that movie.
With the popcorn.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Annette, for that.
I don't guess I saw that.
You didn't see that? Val Kilmer, he looked like he was about 5 years old. It was
I've never seen Real Genius.
Oh man. Okay. Well, go get it.
I'm missing a reference.
Yeah,
I hate that.
that's a major cultural turning point there in my life.
Well, there it is. See, I did plan.
That
is
it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's great though that that you see so many different things going on in solar, because I know, Stephen, we've been talking about a lot of different stuff going on with solar.
Solar is just going nuts lately.
And for a long time it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
It was not the dominant sort of thing for a long time.
Well, oil was cheap, right? I mean, maybe that's...
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what's driving all of this, I suppose.
Well, there's this new thing, and Phil, you're going to love this because it involves nanotech, but what they're doing is they're making, like, molecule-size solar collectors, basically, and what they're doing, it has nothing to do with... It's not. They're starting completely from scratch. This is not photovoltaic at all, okay? It's an antenna that picks up the infrared, okay? The same way like an antenna for a TV set or your cell phone does. And in order for this to work, they had to make the antenna incredibly small. And so it was not possible until they were able to start, you know, basically writing these things as small as it was. And so they make these tiny spirals, and you'll like it for that reason too, Phil, that are these antennas. And apparently they can collect about 80% of the energy from the sun. And even after sunset, the Earth is radiating heat, and it gets that too. And so it works, you know.
So it's just grabbing the heat. It's not the sunlight itself. It's getting that. It's receiving that heat.
It's the infrared spectrum that is what it's getting. And it's cheap. They say, you know, once you get geared up with this, they could, you know, print it out like, you know, pennies a yard.
Now, is this technology was based on some kind of biotech into nanotech? These spiral shapes were originally algae strands or something like that?
I didn't get that from the story I'm reading here. This is totally different from this great solar development that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago. That was photovoltaic, and that was based on the fact that they weren't using as much silicon as what they had to, and so they could, you know, they were, you know, were able to slice the price of photovoltaic solar to make it cheap enough to where it's competitive with the grid. This is not like that at all. This is a totally different route to get energy from the sun. And it's pretty exciting. They say it collects energy great. Our problem now is turning that into electricity, because apparently it's just not doing it right. You know, I mean, the vibrations or the frequency is all wrong for electricity for some reason. But they're working now to figure out a way to convert it into electricity. So
wow, well, exciting development. The thing is, you talk about fusion. There's one argument that says we don't have to develop fusion because we got this great, huge fusion reactor just a mere 93 million miles away. All we have to do is just grab all that fusion energy. And I have this feeling that we're going to see a lot more with solar. It seems like, especially with developments in nanotechnology, that there's just going to be a lot of different ways into that, into solving that problem that are going to create some interesting developments.
I just think like we're going to see a lot of things.
Well,
I mean, it's just, and I don't mean to. That sounded like I was being catty. I mean, I'm just saying that there's just so many opportunities. Like you said, the future is just wide open, Phil. As far as, you know, we could have flex fuel cars, and then we could have biodiesel cars, and we could have air cars, and we could have, you know, full EVs, and we can have hybrid. You know, you name it. I think we're going to see it, and because we're going to try everything. And just to see and let it shake out, see which is the best way to go.
Well, if we get to try them. Now, you know, we've got one commenter saying that the oil companies will never let us do this. So.
Well, I think that's, with respect to our commenter, I think that's just a little cynical, and I think that the oil company doesn't have that kind of power. I mean, particularly when we start seeing, you know, when we start paying $6 and $7 a gallon at the pump, there'll be a market then for something better.
Yeah, I think
the oil companies, you know, as much as they've been saying that, you know, as much as you can say cynically that they may have been doing that all along, at some point you do reach the point where the oil starts getting more and more expensive, and they're the ones who bought all those different, you know, patents to try and stop, you know, those alternate technologies, and they're the ones who hold them, which means that during the switchover, they also end up coming out ahead anyway. It's not surprising that we see a number of oil companies renaming their renaming themselves to energy companies. You know, like I'm thinking of BP Oil, which now is sort of like got this vague energy symbol on its logo instead of oil.
That's true. I mean, when they really smell some money in it for them, you know, that's when some of this stuff will really start to happen, I think. Or they'll get out of the way, right? It's a lot like when you talk about changes to cars, and you say, well, Detroit's going to be a problem, or the car makers are going to be a problem. Well, it's like, yeah, they're slow to change what they're doing because, you know, they've got a lot of infrastructure supporting what they're currently doing. But, you know, they will evolve into other kinds of business models when they sense that they're going to make the money doing it. That's what's going to push them into those kinds of things.
I'm sort of academic in that I'm a diehard sort of capitalist, in that I believe that there's nothing particularly wrong with what we're seeing happen right now, which is that if the oil companies or car companies continue to not innovate, then smaller, nimbler companies that have better options will then be able to take advantage of that to make lots of money and put them out of business.
There you go.
And we're already seeing little bits of that. You know, I'm sitting in a Toyota right now because my cell phone was about to die, so I just went and plugged that in. And I'm intrigued to note that Toyota just became the number one car manufacturer and surpassed Ford and GM. And I noticed one thing that Toyota continues to do, although it's not a small, nimble company, but it is, you know, it's one of the leaders in terms of alternate technology cars. You know, it's well known for the Prius. And while I don't think the Prius is the answer, I think it sort of is a good faith demonstration or advertising on the part of Toyota that, hey, they're willing to go down this direction. And I think it's not surprising that they tend to get a lot of customer switchovers as a result, as people look at the larger and larger gas-guzzling vehicles still being produced by, you know, a sort of Detroit that doesn't seem to think it has to worry about those things.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, to just to bounce off one thought there, it's not historically that long ago that they were a small, nimble company, right?
Yeah.
I think they might have that in their genetics a little more than say the Detroit or the European car makers do.
There's a great book called The Toyota Way, which I think it's written by a guy named Licken or something along those lines. And it's just called The Toyota Way, and it's all about their company genetics, and it's their company DNA, what drives them, and it's incredibly fascinating book to read because they basically are a large company that behaves like a very small and nimble one.
Yeah, and you know, a large company doesn't have to act like a monolith, but often it becomes very easy to do so.
Mm-hmm.
It takes some effort on the part of a large company to remain nimble and be open to ideas, you know, instead of doing just the same thing until
it
stops working.
And that's the beauty of not, you know, being a top-down economy or system, in that, you know, we will, you know, as these possible solutions develop, you know, our feet and money will reward the best solution, and all of them will compete at once. It's kind of the beauty of the system.
That's right. So, yeah, it's wide open. We'll try it all, probably, won't we?
I think, yeah, we will try it all before. You know, don't forget that, you know, before the internal combustion engine achieved the efficiencies necessary to make it a workable solution, that we did try it all at the beginning of the century, the 1900s. You know, in the 1900s, there were coal, steam-powered, electric, and internal combustion engines all used in car designs until finally the internal combustion gasoline engine began to edge them out.
Right.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, you know, one of the things that was tried back then, compressed air.
That's right.
But,
nice way to bring it back around.
What goes around comes around, huh?
That's
really interesting. So that might be interesting if that became the dominant model after all, after
mm-hmm.
a century or more of internal combustion engine. All right, well, Stephen, I think we're probably a little bit past our time.
Yeah, we are.
But I just want to paint one picture here, because he said it so glancingly. But I want everyone to understand that our guest Tobias left the comfort of his room, went outside into a car, to plug his phone in so he could stay on the show with us.
I really like you guys.
Did I get that right? Is that what you're telling us you did?
Yeah.
I thought we'd be on for an hour, and that was solid, and my phone started to beep, so I had to quickly cover the mouthpiece so you guys couldn't hear me moving about, and get out here and plug it into the car so I could continue to talk, so I wasn't sure how much longer we'd be.
Well, you're a great guest anyway, but I mean,
he's such a gracious guest.
Status here.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons we like having you on the show so well, Tobias. You're a good sport, man. you do whatever it takes to be a good guest, and that's great.
What a trooper! Absolutely.
He really is.
Well, we really appreciate you being on the program. We enjoyed, as always, talking with you. Thanks for
thank you. It's
taking the time.
Total pleasure to be here. Pleasure.
We need to pump this one more time. Tobias, you've got online Crystal Rain, the first third of the book. Is that right?
Yeah, I always post the first third of the novel that's currently out.
And you're going to get to do this with the book you just turned in as well, right?
You Sly Mongoose. So far, no one's told me no. So I'm assuming that we will also. You know, what happens is about a month before, so I start to post a chapter a day, leading up to the event of the launch of the book.
So if you want to get a taste of what Tobias writes, you got no excuse. You can go
take a taste. Follow the links. We're providing them on Speculus.com, or just go straight to Amazon and buy the books, by golly. You don't keep this man in cell phone batteries. Let's keep it going here, huh?
Yeah. Well, again, Tobias, thank you. And we got some music tonight. Christopher B. Crowder, his song is Smell the Coffee.
Smell the coffee. All right. Well, as we go to sleep, we will be smelling the coffee. Thanks, Stephen, and thank you again, Tobias.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks for all those listening. We look forward to being with you again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.